Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Bloody Awesome Movie Podcast. I'm John Burke, and with me from across the pond is the Kingsman to my statesman, Matt Hudson from whatiwatchtonight.co.uk. Matt, how's it going, sir?
Going good, my friend John, as ever. It's another week, another list of films to get through, but who else would I rather do it with than JB? No one. So I'm doing very well. How are you?
I'm doing quite well. I'm on my first week of summer vacation. So I've been kind of taking it easy. I watched a few movies yesterday. Today I played a little bit of video games and took my daughter to lunch because she's also on summer vacation. Nice. A very late lunch we had today, but nevertheless. I'm trying to ease in to the school year. I actually did work a little yesterday, but I'm getting some of my college class stuff ready for next semester. I'm trying to enjoy my break and actually break this summer, which it actually leads a really good point into what this episode is going to be a little different. We are here to talk about our movie of the week that if you are listening every week, you know what movie that is. But we're also going to be previewing a film festival that Matt and I are going to be covering over the next couple of weeks that we'll get into about halfway. But it's going to be not a longer episode, but we're going to really dive into a bunch of movies that you will have access to if you want to participate at the Tribeca Online Festival. I totally just name dropped the festival on accident. Otherwise you will have to wait for a while. That's part of film festivals are that a lot of times the movies are trying to get distribution. And usually my experience with this particular festival is it's about a year later before the movies are available to the public outside of the festival. So this is a really important episode if you're interested in partaking in an online film festival this year, because we're going to be talking about the movies we're excited about, the movies that we're going to be watching, not all of them, because there's a lot of movies and we're going to be watching quite a few over the next couple of weeks, but our next two episodes are going to be dedicated to this film festival. We're going to be covering films from that festival, talking about them, as well as both of our websites. You're going to be able to read our reviews of the movies that we watch. So BurkeReviews.com, whatiwatchtonight.co.uk are going to be your hub for Matt and I Tribeca coverage. And again, we'll get into that more specifically in just a moment. But I think we should dive into our movie of the week. What do you think, Matt?
I think so. Just don't mention the film festival yet, though. We want to keep everyone in suspense, if you wouldn't mind.
Yes. I'm really good at the setup.
I think we'll spend more time on the festival than the film, to be fair.
Yes, I agree. In fact, what film? We're here to talk about The Conjuring, The Devil Made Me Do It, recently released on both HBO Max and theatrical release. I went to the theater to see this one. It's directed by Michael Chavez, written by David Leslie and Johnson McGoldrick. I feel like that's not the right names. IMDb and I were fighting this morning, and I think I copied something incorrectly. I will double check that. But
yeah.
James Wan gets the story credit, of course, because he started the Conjuring film franchise way back when with The Conjuring. I'm trying to get to The Conjuring's other page, but nevertheless, I'll continue. It stars Patrick Wilson and Vera Farmiga reprising their roles as the Warrens, Rory O'Connor, and yes, Matt, I had to look that name up. I had no idea how to say that one.
Well,
would have guessed Rory.
I'm sitting there in tenterhooks waiting for you to Rua Erie, but no, you got it.
Yep. It definitely doesn't look like Rory to me, but Sarah Catherine Hook, Julian Hilliard, John Noble, Eugenie Bondurant, and Shannon Cook are some of the other actors that are in this movie. The synopsis, very simple. The Warrens investigate a murder that may be linked to a demonic possession. It would be weird if it was just a murder. 59% RT, 53 Metascore, so about middling movie, and a 6.5 only IMDb user score, which I think speaks volumes. By comparison, if the critics and the users are sitting around the same area, it's usually a sign of a consensus, more so than we get with a lot of movies, especially a lot of horror films. Critics can be pretty harsh on horror films, and I have found in the past that critically acclaimed horror doesn't always mesh with the public and vice versa. Public loved horror films are often critically panned, with exceptions of the greats, right? Like there are the ones that everybody loves, but this is Oh, I'm sorry. It was one name. David Leslie Johnson McGoldrick is one person. There is no oh,
damn.
And there.
Greedy so-and-so.
Yeah, so lots of names there. They got all the names.
All the names.
So, that said, I love The Conjuring. I really think that movie is so well made. I found it very compelling, the whole story of the Warrens. I was not familiar with the Warrens before I saw The Conjuring. Somehow I never really heard about them or paid attention to them if they were in my presence in some capacity. So I found it really interesting, and I thought it was cool to bring attention to these people. Now, I didn't do a lot of research after seeing The Conjuring, but it's important to note, I am a cynic when it comes to ghosts. I want to believe in hauntings and stuff, not because I want to experience them, because I think it's an interesting concept. I myself have never experienced anything I would consider to be supernatural, or even supranatural. And, I generally would say I'm very skeptical of anyone saying they saw a ghost or any ghost things. And that's not to just, like, if you are one of those people who have experienced or believe something, I'm not trying to say you're a liar or anything like that. I just personally have never witnessed it. And so I usually take this type of thing with a grain of salt. I thought The Conjuring 2 was a much lesser film, and I think The Conjuring verse as a collective has not been great. I haven't seen all of the movies, but I've seen enough to think it's not great. Okay. I think this film is bad in a lot of reasons, but I think the biggest is I don't feel like it's a horror film. I think they went real hard on it being an action movie, and the Warrens are positioned as these like heroes who are fighting a antagonist, as opposed to paranormal investigators trying to understand these supernatural forces at work. And this one is in particularly problematic because of the precedent it attempts to set in the court system, that a person who has killed someone can claim the devil made them do it. That is a slippery slope at best. And I think one of the things that really bugged me about the decisions of this movie, and we talked while I was watching it, I couldn't help but text Matt some things because I was just like actively frustrated with certain elements. But listeners, if you're new to the show, we don't spoil here. We have a special mini episode where we do talk spoilers, but that's released separate. So no concerns here. I'm not going to spoil this film. But this movie, there are going to be demonic related or ghost stuff in this film. So that's what I'm going to loosely refer to those. I won't give any explicit details to the scenes, but the way they showcase the moments of horror and demonic possession in this film feel too fantastic to also then claim this is based on a true story. Because Chavez, I was starting to say, I pointed out some very clear homages that Chavez makes to other horror films of history. Something a lot of filmmakers do. I mean, you could cite Tarantino, you could cite Edgar Wright. Paying reference to the movies that they grew up on is very commonplace in art. And again, the movie brats from the 70s did that with the movies from the 40s and 50s. Like, it is the nature of art. We always mimic and then build upon. Sometimes it feels like homage. Like, I think when Tarantino does it or when Edgar Wright does it, it feels like an artist using someone else's palette to help express their own thoughts. Other times, it feels like an artist ripping people off. I'm looking at you, Todd Phillips, and the Joker. So, I can't quite put my finger on how to articulate the difference of when it's homage and when it's a ripoff. When it's clearly an artist paying tribute to something that inspired them and then giving their own voice to it versus just borrowing from a better story, a better film, and not really understanding what you're doing. And I don't know where Chavez falls, but he clearly references two iconic horror films. I won't say which, so I don't spoil anything, but I think in the attempt to do that, he also embeds that aesthetic into this film at times that I need to rewatch The Conjuring, to be fair, to like really make this a strong argument, because I don't know if I'm right in how Juan presents it, but I feel like the horror in the first movie feels more in line with a true story by comparison to this. Like, there's a scene here where it's so over the top that if anybody had witnessed it, the entire world wouldn't have known about it. Right.
Yes.
And so it negates the concept of a true story, which is fine if you don't claim it to be a true story. But then in the other movies, there is no legal precedent either. This is a true story. These 10 people witnessed. Now, this is a court-ordered case. The federal prison system is involved. There are other witnesses that in normal situations would not have been present. So it requires that the film feel more grounded, and it doesn't. It goes way big at times. So Hollywood, so spectacular. I mean, I'd love to see the budget on the smoke machines alone for this movie, because it gets super foggy. And it's not to say it doesn't look good. It just feels like it's in conflict with its own storytelling. And then again, you add in the 80s action element that I feel like they've really pushed. I think The Conjuring 2 starts it. I feel like the Warrens were more observers in the first movie. I could be wrong. Again, it's been a while since I've seen it. But Conjuring 2, I feel like they start to have this kind of like us against the demon kind of thing, especially when they start introducing the nun in Conjuring 2.
Yeah.
And this one feels full on. It's like, it's John McClane versus, Hans Gruber. Like it's such a me versus you protagonist antagonist vibe. And, it didn't fully mesh with me, as a result. I don't want the Warrens to be superpowered. I want the Warrens to be people who have an understanding and can help communicate this idea without it being like a blatant action wannabe. Cause it never felt truly scary to me. Like I never felt the tension or the atmosphere click in that made it feel like a horror film. That's not to say the scenes aren't well stylized or thought out. It's just, I felt like, well, I in an 80s action film, I always assume the good guy's going to win. And that's what this felt like. And there's some thematic things that I feel really get like forced in towards the end of the film that also didn't feel earned. It felt like you're just like, nope, we're just going to throw this in. And overall, I thought it was okay. I found it a little more boring than not. Julian Hilliard, I just watched all of, and I'll talk about this in a little bit, but I just watched all of Haunting of Hill House, and he is one of the kid actors in that. And so I already kind of wasn't sold on him, and I really didn't think he did a terrific job in this movie, not to fault him. But yeah, I don't know. I definitely think this is a clear lesser of the three Conjuring films. It's better than The Nun. and I only made it through like half of the Curse of La Llorona on the plane, and it feels better than that, but still doesn't, like, if you were to compare this straight up to The Conjuring, it is night and day different movies, and it doesn't feel nearly as compelling as the first Conjuring film. So I was lukewarm, maybe a little less than the critic score overall. What about you, Matt? What did you think of The Conjuring Devil Made Me Do It?
Well, like you say, it's set on a true story, you know, loosely based, and the title of the film is directly linked to the case files, but it's still an awful title. I've said that every time I speak about this film, and I'll still say it. The Devil Made... Oh, at the moment that the title dropped, I was like, this is one of the worst titles I've heard in years, and it still is. As for the film, as for the Conjuringverse, yeah, I'm with you. I think The Conjuring, 2013's The Conjuring, is great. I think it's one of the better contemporary horrors of that decade, because it was stripped back. It worked with the tools that it had, low budget, atmosphere. Yes, it obviously got bigger as it went on, but it played to all of its strengths. And I think it is genuinely creepy. That film is quite creepy. The second one I didn't like. 2 hours, 20 minutes for that horror film. In the introduction of the CG characters, which suddenly changed the rules of the game, which is what has happened ever since The Conjuring, ever since that first film. None of the films have been able to establish the in-universe rules, which is very jarring to me. Like you said, they're trying to keep it grounded and real, but then you'll see something like The Crooked Man, which, okay, that's now, the rules are out. The Nun, they can't establish the rules of that universe in that film. Everything's just, and this film does it as well. I can't say how and when yet, but that's the problem. And in terms of the Conjuringverse, yeah, love the first one. Second one, not a fan of. The Annabelle films, I like the second one, Annabelle Creation. Annabelle and Come Home, don't like. The Nun, Curse of La Llorona, awful horror films, new old, whatever. So I don't know how many films that is. That's 6, 8 maybe. Only one of them's really any good. This one, I think, is solid, as you say. I didn't actually mind this one, and I shouldn't sound so surprised. I thought it was all right. I thought there were some decent horror moments in it, like tension moments of tension. But there's also Chavez, who directed The Curse of La Llorona, also uses the, you know, let's look over there, nothing there, turn around, there's something there. That trope too much. And you can see it coming from a mile off. And yeah, it works in the cinema, but it's not great on rewatches. So I thought there were some good set pieces. I thought the opening was really good. Like the opening half an hour was actually really solid. Anything that surrounded the character of Arnie, I actually preferred that to what anything the Warrens did. That felt a lot more real. That was, you know, what I was there to see, what was happening to this guy. Vera Farmiga, Patrick Wilson, again, I think their chemistry is wonderful. And it is, I generally believe them as an on-screen husband and wife who have been through things together. I believe it. Now, like you said, thematically, there are some things surrounding them which I thought were utter crap as well in this film. And it made me roll my eyes hard. But... Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it was fine. It gets a bit bombastic and loud as it goes on. But I liked John Noble in this film. I have to say that. I think John Noble, Denethor, for our Middle Earth friends, I did think he was like genuinely creepy. I think he was the creepiest part of the film. Just him as a, not John Noble, his characters. John Noble's a thespian, and so his deliverance of words and his, just the way he looks and the way he could portray stuff with his face, I thought he was really, really quite good in this film, John Noble, and I was surprised to see him. I didn't know he was in this film. It looks good. It's the sound design is good. I too saw this in theatres over here in jolly old England. So I'm just, you know, but they do with the Warrens is at one part worrying, but we'll mention that maybe in the spoiler part. And also, like you say, they're not anymore. They're not just experts in their field, or, you know, people who can come along to aid something. They are the investigation now. They're leading investigations into murder, and they've almost become OP in their own universe, which I don't like, because that's, again, especially when you're dealing with real life people. And again, I'll speak about that in the spoiler review, but I think they focus too much on the Warrens. Yes, this is their case files. However, everything outside of what they were doing was much more interesting, I think. There were scenes. There was a scene that involves a morgue, which I think was good, which involves them, and I think was really good. You know, really, again, well shot, well set, good tension. But then something else happens immediately after, and I think, it's just, what's going on here? So I would give this, you know, more towards the IMDb score. I'd give it a 6 if I was going to be pushed to rate it now. Because I do think it was above average, not by much, but in terms of the Conjuring-verse, as it's been called, it's one of the better ones in the Conjuring-verse. And again, that isn't saying an awful lot, but...
No.
I thought it was a solid, if unspectacular, and probably quite a forgettable horror film.
Yeah, I agree with that. It's I've actually been kind of on a horror kick recently, too. I don't know why exactly, because frequently I'm not a big fan of horror, but I've actually just really wanted to watch horror lately. And Martin Scorsese, by coincidence, released his top 11. I don't know why he did 11, but he did 11, to mess with people with OCD. But he did his top 11 horror films, and I've been kind of working my way through them. I will share. I made a list on Letterboxd.
Thank you,
I'll post that in the show notes even. I by coincidence, I just watched The Haunting from 63, which is on his list.
Of course.
So I was excited. I was like, oh, I've seen that one. There's this movie I've never heard of. It's called The Exorcist.
Sounds awful.
Exorcizer? I don't know, man. It's got some like street lamp. I don't know. I've never heard of
sounds
it.
Sounds lame.
It's Kubrick's The Shining, of course, Psycho. I just watched, and I'll talk about a couple of these in a minute, but there's a few other movies on the list. I'm going to kind of work my way through. Three of them you can't watch without either getting the Criterion Channel or buying the Criterion Blu-ray. Oh no, what a shame, because that's coming up in July, everybody. but yeah, so like, that's been kind of my draw. And then I think Psycho Gorman kind of made me realize I like kind of B horror, like monster flicks like that. So I rented another one. I'll talk about it. I keep forgetting I'm going to be talking about a lot of this in a few minutes, but I've been watching a lot of horror.
John,
and
slap your hand, slap your wrist.
I know. But this particular film I was really disappointed in. And I actually have found a lot of times I'm disappointed in horror. I used to get scared much easier. And I think I liked that part. And that's not I don't feel like this movie does a good job of trying to scare its audience as much as it's like, I've seen a bunch of horror films and I'm going to do some really cool aesthetic stuff. I think there's some really good looking stuff in this movie, but it just never quite hit for me. Like, and I don't know if it was the characters or if it's maybe like I think there's a lot of like over foreshadowing of like things that are going to happen or that you're going to expect to happen. And then again, there is that we are cross cutting so much between, Arnie and the Warrens. And it's like, I agree. The Warrens are not the compelling part of this movie. Like they're not actively engaging with the part of it that I want to see. And, I want to feel a little bit of dread when I watch a horror film, and I never really felt it.
There's a big reason for that as well, but again, I'll mention that in the spoiler episode.
So that's our review. Matt and I both lukewarm on The Conjuring. Matt's a little bit more up on it than I am. I have been a little harsher on horror collectively, I think, as a genre. I know what I want from a horror film, and if it doesn't click for me, I want to feel scared when I'm done with it. That's the ultimate bottom line for me. If a movie doesn't make me feel something emotionally, whether it's terror or, you know, dread, I'm going to have issues if it's a horror film. A Quiet Place too. I was on the edge of my seat for big chunks of that movie. That's not to say I thought it was perfect, but I at least had emotional reactions to it. The Conjuring, I was just like, my emotional reaction is it over yet? And it kept not being over yet. So, that's our review for The Conjuring. The Devil Made Me Do It.
Hey.
And my dog has decided to bark. Thank you, lady.
The dog made you do it. Or the devil made him do it.
Made me do it. So that said, let's move into what would normally be Chopped Headlines, except it's not headlines this week, folks. It is our Tribeca preview spectacular. What we're doing this week is we're going to be looking ahead to the Tribeca Film Festival, which we will include a link to the show notes, but you can watch at home. You can buy individual ticket prices, and I believe there's even packages for the online viewing, so you can see multiple movies. There is a festival, actually a physical festival happening in New York, but it is limited in capacity, still trying to be safe, and obviously there's travel restrictions, but those restrictions do not carry over to the online format. The festival officially begins on June 9th, so the day before you're hearing this, but it doesn't end till the 20th, so you have a lot of opportunities to see these movies. Again, a link in the show notes, but you can also go to TribecaFilm.com. I have covered the Tribeca Film Festival for the last 3 years. This will be my fourth year covering it, but this will be Matt's first year getting to participate because of this online element. He doesn't have to leave England, which is helpful.
It's a shame. Obviously my dream in life is to, at some point in the next, year, get over to the States and share a Blue Moon and some keto or diet-friendly food with Burke. But it would have been lovely as well to head off to New York City and do it as well and get some pizza. But hey, I think this is great. Yes, I'm also quite biased, but this also opens the world up as well for people to attend, let's say, London Film Festival or TIFF or, you know, Sydney Film, whatever it might be. I honestly think this is a great initiative to have a virtual screenings. You know, it's obviously you want to be there to be able to experience the buzz of the festival. Yeah, it's tiring, but come on, watching films to recover them, being able to go to the Q&As, seeing the talent, potentially getting the chance to speak with them if you can get up close and personal. You know, that's what you get for going there. However, for me, sitting here, obviously we're in a COVID world, but being able to, you know, cover a huge festival like this, it's incredible. I'm very appreciative for Tribeca for even considering an oik like me. So the Bloody Awesome Movie Podcast will be giving some bloody awesome coverage. Thank you to Tribeca.
And with that, we're going to jump into this. So Matt and I have picked some movies we're going to just highlight. There are way more movies than we're going to cover here. Yeah. So for full coverage, I would say go to TribecaFilm.com. And they have this year a virtual guide that you can download as a PDF, which is this. I'm sad because I didn't get to go to the festival last year, but I covered it online. But the two years before that, I actually have the books in my possession that is like this digital guide. So I really wish I had a physical one of this year. There's a lot of movies at this festival this year. I'm actually pretty hyped about what's going to be here. Some stuff I didn't know was coming out. Again, listener, this is the best chance to see these films before they'll be readily available. It's often a year. They have to get picked up for distribution. Some of these films won't get picked up for distribution, unfortunately, yep. because most of them deserve to be seen. There's obviously a lot more distributors now, and there's a lot more outlets for these filmmakers to have their movies shown. Yep. But festivals are a great place to do it. So
you can be that person who can say to your friends, hey, have you seen this film called so-and-so? No? Well, I did. I saw it last year when it was still cool. So you could be that person as well. And some of these films could end up in your, if you catch them, in your best of the year list, which is also an exciting thing to think about.
And that's the thing. Last year, some of my favorite films were small indie films that debuted at festivals. We could throw out Promising Young Woman, The Sound of Metal. Never Rarely, Sometimes Always, I believe was a Sundance film, if I'm not mistaken. Yep. Which was before COVID, and then The Donut Man, which is now on The Donut King, which is now on Hulu. A film I saw at a Vietnamese festival last year was fantastic. Several of the films that Matt and I watched during our Fantasia coverage of last year is now on Shudder.
Some of them made it into my top like 10-15 of the year. Not Fried Berry, but others did.
Yeah, but again, Fried Berry, not for us, but definitely exactly what the filmmaker wanted to do, and good for him.
Working for a lot of people.
Yes. Our point is there's a chance that a movie that you would love is playing at, if not this festival, a festival. And that's why we try to encourage to break out from the mainstream. Don't just watch what is, shown on trailer after trailer after trailer at every theater or every TV show, but look for these gems because there might be a story that you connect with on a level that you just can't even put to words. I think that people like Matt and I have found we had that experience with a movie early on in our life, and it just made us constantly look for more. Yeah. We found that connection with the film, and it brought us into a world of cinema. If you don't love movies, I posit that you just haven't seen that movie for you yet, but it exists. It's out there. You just haven't found it. And to me, this is an opportunity to explore. So that's how we're going to approach this. We're going to highlight these movies. Again, we're not going to talk too long about each one because this is just a preview. We haven't seen any of these movies yet. These are movies we're planning on watching. Again, we're going to have written reviews, but we're also going to be talking about these on the next couple of episodes of the podcast. So you will hear spoiler-free versions of all of these. Same thing, Matt and I both write spoiler-free with our reviews. It's more of our general thoughts, kind of an overview of what we took in and what stood out to us and why we either think you should watch it or why you shouldn't. So pay attention to those covers. You might be able to watch a movie after we've already seen it. Sometimes there are timestamps of when you can watch these films, so like it will vary from case to case. But it looks like, from what I'm seeing at Tribeca, though, the online is it releases after the physical premiere, but then it will have the entire run of the festival, so you'll be able to rent it at any time. So everything we're going to talk about here, you will have access until it looks like the 23rd or the 25th, given the online streaming elements. From what I'm seeing, like the first one I'm looking at here, but
I hear that. But I would also just want to just back up your point there on festivals, because I do sometimes feel that there is a divide similar to how they used to be with production, where film and TV were very much separate. You know, you didn't cross-pollinate. And I do sometimes feel that, festival films aren't considered to be films that people want to watch, as opposed to the ones you get at theatres. You know, for the mainstream audience, there's something in my head, which to me, a lot of people don't consider them to be, true film because they're not coming out in the cinemas per se. And in my head, it makes sense. It just seems to be like a weird sort of stigma attached to festival films. Like the ones we're going to mention, I haven't heard of a lot of these, but just because of that doesn't make them any less of a good. Some of these films could be absolutely monstrously good, or they could be awful. Same as if I go to the theatre to watch a film. But obviously the ones in theatre get so much more attention, so much more press coverage that kind of one of think that sometimes festival releases, other than like the major festival releases, but festivals are kind of seen as just like quirky indie films, which, you know, somebody else can watch. But no, you got to, we've all got to stop doing that, because some of the best films I've seen in the last few years have been festival films, which may or may not actually have distribution yet still. So yeah, don't sleep on them.
Yeah. And I think the easiest, like proof that Hollywood doesn't always know what we like is if you've ever seen a movie that got tons and tons of promotion ahead of its release and then you didn't like it, proof that they don't always know what you're going to like, right?
Exactly.
They're gambling on what they think the public wants, but there's a lot of movies don't work out that way. We're very disappointed. We're unhappy with it. And the same is true with these movies at festivals. Sometimes these movies are outstanding and you're like, why don't more people know about this? And other times I've walked away from some pretty bad movies, or movies that I thought were pretty bad, from a festival. But at the same time, I watch a lot of movies at festivals. Mm-hmm. And so I expect to only like a handful a lot, because not every movie's for me, right? Like, not every movie's designed for me. So again, we're previewing these with no other than like the premise or the concept or the type of movie. And that's all we got. Sometimes it's an actor that makes us like, ooh, I like that actress or that actor.
Yeah.
Or there's a filmmaker that I like who's maybe just attached as a producer, which is the case for at least two of these, but that's enough for me to be like, well, I like that filmmaker enough that I'm going to trust their judgment. If they felt they should back another filmmaker, I'm going to give that film the benefit of the doubt. I hope to like about half of these movies that we're going to talk about today. And if I do, then I will say that's a win, but we'll see what happens.
Yeah. Same. I hope to like all of them, but hey, yeah. Numbers, ratios.
I'm being realistic. That's the difference. I'm being, knowing myself, I won't like all of these for sure. And sometimes it's, again, it's not that it's bad. It's just like, man, you see the potential. You're like, this movie could have been the best movie ever. And instead it's just fine, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which is not necessarily a bad thing, but. All right. Matt, you want to start us off? Pick a movie, any movie?
Yeah, I'll go with one of the ones at the top. It's called All My Friends Hate Me, which is a nice, cheery way to start things off. It's billed as a horror comedy thriller directed by Andrew Gaynord. And it's got Tom Stoughton, Charlie Clive, Georgina Campbell in as well. And in short, the premise is Pete is very insecure. He hasn't seen his college mates for a long time, for years. But they're getting together at a country house. And these guys are a bit raucous, you know, they like to make fun of Pete a little bit. But Pete takes his girlfriend there for the very first time, so they get to meet him as well. Pete also wants to propose. So there's that. But as the synopsis says, best laid plans, dear audience. So they say it's a poignantly appropriate for our socially anxious times. It's a black comedy, hilariously smart story of one man's paranoia, so thick with suspicion that the lines between truth and simple insecurity become fuzzier with each passing minute. So it's they call it a don't miss it comedy that only nails scene after scene of cringeworthy moments and high tension as it goes on. So a little horror comedy to start things up, an ensemble cast. And as somebody who's done many cringeworthy things in my life, I'm looking forward to seeing how I can relate to this. But so I thought I like a good horror comedy when it's done well. And, you know, synopsis, like John said, we haven't seen this film. We haven't got access to anything other than synopsis and an image. But I'm looking for, this is one which kind of grabbed me. A horror comedy about a insecure fellow who's been thrown back in with his friends who are clearly at odds with him, but he's taking his girlfriend there for the first time, and it's a horror as well. How is it all going to work? I've no idea, but All My Friends Hate Me is the first film on my list. I guess it isn't in any order of preference either, but so I'm looking forward to seeing that one, my friend.
I'm interested in that one. I do want to preface two things before I give my movie. One, I want to give credit to Big Tuna. We were going to try to have Big Tuna record with us to do this, because he, Big Tuna from Disappointments Media, he helped us pick out some of these movies. He does a lot of prep and he sees way more movies than I don't understand how he watches so many movies.
No, he doesn't really sleep.
He must not, because he also goes to school and he also works. So I don't know where he's finding all the time, but he's already actually seen some of the movies that we're going to be talking about. Big shout out for him helping us kind of sort through all the films and pick out some. And this first one he recommended to me, it's called 7 Days, which this I also the second preface that I mentioned is the one downside of at a film festival a year after a pandemic is there's going to be a lot of pandemic based stories. There's just gonna be not all of them, but some of them. And this one, honestly, I didn't even realize it was pandemic based until I was just now reading the synopsis, but everything else around it sounds so good that I'm okay with it. So 7 Days is part of the Viewpoints series. One of the things about Tribeca that's really cool is they break up the movies into different categories. So there's going to be some like that are competing for best narrative or best documentary. And then there's these Viewpoints where they try to give a microphone to the less represented in cinema at times. Mm-hmm. So it'll be a non-white male director. So one of those criteria. It might be a white female director, or it might be an LGBTQ plus director, or it might be a foreign filmmaker, or you know, a non-American filmmaker or something, to give voice to someone else. This movie is set up on a prearranged date by their old-fashioned Indian parents, Ravi, played by Karan Soni, and Rita, Geraldine Viswanathan. It's definitely not
Viswanathan.
Oh, there you go. I could have got the Athan because that's totally how my name is said. But nevertheless, seemingly having nothing in common, making for an afternoon that, while pleasant enough, couldn't be any more awkward. So it's got a romantic comedy vibe where the COVID tie-in is, as the COVID outbreak intensifies, the shelter-in-place mandate is issued, forcing Ravi to spend the night at Rita's place. So they get kind of shoved in a room together. Now, I like these two actors a lot. Yeah. So I'm sold by them. And then I love rom-coms. Like, if you've been listening to this podcast, you know that's true. Mm-hmm. It's directed by Roshan Sethi. I'm not familiar with them as a filmmaker, but I'm excited. This movie, right up my alley. I think Tuna specifically recommended this one for me, and it makes perfect sense because, again, it's checking a lot of my boxes. I'm definitely one of the first ones that I'm going to get to watch. I think we're going to be able to watch it on Friday, and mm-hmm. it'll probably be one of the first ones that I watch as well. It's definitely on the earliest list of movies that we'll have access to. So mm-hmm. I am very pumped to give that one a watch.
Yeah, good shout, my friend. That one looks good. Again, the cast looks good. And just looking at the resume of the director, a rising star. So interested for that one. You had another one down for an early bird as well, didn't you?
Yeah, you want me to go back to back, huh? All right.
Yeah, go on. You do that.
I can do it, man. I can do it. Again, another big Tuna wreck. Although, not knowing he'd recommended this, I saw the banner picture for this and was immediately like, oh, I'm going to watch this because of this actress. I am a big fan of Haley Law. Mm-hmm. She was in The New Romantic with Jesse Barden, and I thought she was like standout in that movie. She's the best friend. So, so good. And then she's the best friend in Spontaneous, which I also think she's amazing. And she's not in it enough, in my opinion, but I love that movie so much, I will forgive it. But she appears to be the lead, and that was like, oh, awesome, because I haven't seen her get that opportunity. And so I was hooked right away. So this movie's called Mark, Mary, and Some Other People. I'm assuming Haley Law is going to be playing Mary. Maybe Mark. Who knows? Mark and Mary's,
Some Other People.
And again, another rom-com, so in my wheelhouse. Mark and Mary, Mary's meet-cute happens at a neighborhood drugstore where she is busy buying a pregnancy test, and he has to make an effort to remind her they met in college. After asking her out, he accompanies her as she takes the test, and upon showing negative, she agrees to a date. 1 year later, they have fallen deeply, passionately, head over heels in love, and their whirlwind romance leads to marriage. So when Mary suddenly requests they open their relationship to ethical non-monogamy, Mark is taken by surprise, but agrees to try it. So Ben Rosenfield and Haley Law, written and directed by Hannah Marks. I am very into the premise of this. This sounds like it'll be funny, but also it's listed as a drama as well, which so was the last film, so there's going to be the serious elements, but so much about this just appeals to me. I think Law has a really great sense of comedy, mm-hmm. and so her getting that opportunity I think will be really, really funny. She's got a good kind of satirical sarcasm about her that I thought worked really well in New Romantic, and it also worked really well in Spontaneous. And I don't know if it's the role she's picking or if it's just her natural like personality coming into the roles, but she's really good at downplaying the drama of not making it feel melodramatic, but also not undercutting it, not making it feel like it's not, there's no stakes, but also like, hey, but let's be real. Life goes on. Sure. This is tough. Sure. This is sad,
mm-hmm.
but we'll be okay. Like it always has that vibe to me, even in Spontaneous, which was a pretty stressful movie. I felt like she was able to bring like, no, this is serious and the stakes are high, but ultimately I'm going to do what I'm going to do. And we're just going to have to keep living. And I really like that. And especially now it feels like we need that kind of vibe in our movies, a little bit of positivity. So,
Yep. Hannah Marx directed it. Rolling Stone named her as one of their 25 artists who are under 25 who are changing the world. And Forbes also put her in her 30 under 30 as well. So, you know,
wow.
And again, director, rising star, good cast alert there. And that synopsis sounds quite fun as well. So I'm in. I'm sold for that one as well, my friend. My next one is a film called No Man of God, world premiere. This one is directed by Amber Seeley. And she's an award-winning filmmaker who's done a lot of cool stuff. And this one stars Elijah Wood and Luke Kirby as your main stars. And it's a drama thriller. And the synopsis, it says, it was a radical new approach to criminal investigations, profiling. Through one-on-one discussions with serial offenders, FBI researchers could go much more in-depth. FBI analyst Bill Hagemeyer, Elijah Wood, emboldened by this new philosophy, sat down with famed serial killer Ted Bundy, played by Luke Kirby, for several interviews from 84 to 89 inside Florida State Prison in hopes of figuring out why Bundy murdered more than 20 victims. What started out as a straightforward informational assignment gradually turned personal for Hagemeyer, whose feelings about his charismatic subject grew more complicated with each conversation. Is it possible to empathize with evil? So true crime resonates with me on a certain level. I don't like the idea of glorifying killers or anything like that. And that's always my worry going into any film like this. Are they going to try and really play on the fact that Ted Bundy was this charismatic charmer? Because that is what he was. You know, that's how he got so much of his, you know, so many of his victims to fall prey to him. I don't want them to play on that too much. And glorify the man, but it's always something that interests me going in is what angle are they going to go for? Is this going to be 100 minutes of, you know, Elijah Wood and Luke Kirby face to face, with Elijah Wood trying to unravel the mind of Bundy? Interesting. I like the sound of this. We mentioned off here we had Extremely Wicked, Shock and Vile with Zac Efron as Ted Bundy a few years back, which I quite liked that film. So we're getting another Ted Bundy film a few years later. I mean, the Bundy one got some controversy because people thought they were glamorizing him. I don't think they were in that film. So I'm looking to see if they do here, but I like me a good drama and I like me a good thriller. So No Man of God, my next choice.
And with that, just bringing attention to those at home who want to watch this, it's going to be available to start to rent on June 12th. However, yeah. This one has a shorter window. It looks like they're going to remove it on the 14th. So if you do want to watch it, you're going to need to watch it this weekend. So keep that in mind. It looks like some movies will have a long window where you'll have like a week or two to watch it. And movies like this, that I think they're expecting probably to get distribution because it's of the cast and stuff.
Yeah.
It's a smaller window. So definitely if you hear something that sounds compelling to you, go check the website, TribecaFilm.com, and find out when you can see it, because we don't want you to miss it. Like, don't think that every film's going to have that 2-week window, as they don't. So, that said, listener, we're going to talk about a movie that is about a movie. Back in the old days, I think it's 99, 2000. I'm going to confirm this. There's a movie called, oh God, it's older. It's 95. Wow. I was way too young when I saw this movie. Kids, 1995, directed by Larry Clark, introduces quite a few big name actresses. We get Chloe Sevigny's debut and Rosario Dawson's debut in this film, both of whom I'm big fans of. Chloe, you most likely listener, you've seen in the American Horror Story show. And she's in a lot of stuff, but that's where I think a lot of America will have seen her. Rosario Dawson most recently would have been on The Mandalorian season 2. As mm-hmm. Ahsoka Tano, but she's in tons of stuff. She's, you know, bounced around in some Kevin Smith things. But Kids was extremely controversial at the time. because they were basically real teenagers being portrayed doing what teenagers probably do, but most parents did not want to accept. And worse was it, this was post the AIDS like epidemic in the 80s. But one of the main characters of that movie, Kids, is just awful. He finds out he has AIDS, but doesn't stop fooling around with girls, and it's awful. But this movie at Tribeca is called The Kids, and it is a documentary about that movie from 1995. It has been 26 years since Larry Clark's notorious indie cult classic Kids was released to unsuspecting nations. Shot on the streets of Greenwich Village and starring a cast of real New York teenagers, the film immediately became a lightning rod for controversy. Labeled as a sex and drug-fueled tale of excess and moral depravity, it still went on to become a bona fide hit, which inspired intense debate and scrutiny. Over the decades, the film has continued to gather a devoted following, and it is responsible for birthing the careers of auteur Harmony Korine, who would go into Spring Breakers, and there's a couple other movies Korine has done that. Gummo, I think, is the other big one. And actresses Rosario Dawson and Chloe Sevigny. But what happened to the rest of the kids? That's, I guess, this documentary is going to attempt to answer those questions. There's some dark stuff that comes of it. I recently read an article about it, so I'm very intrigued by this documentary. That was a movie, again, I was way too young. I was 13, I guess, maybe 14 when I saw it for the first time. But it was a regular on HBO, so I would watch it a lot. And I didn't... I just found it so different than all the other films I was watching, because they weren't actors, but they were trying. And I remember even kind of criticizing, like, "Duh, this performance is so mediocre." But then there were the standouts like Chloe and Rosario, who you could tell have what it takes to become actors and actresses. Mm-hmm. But I'm really excited to check this out, because I haven't seen that movie in years, probably since the 90s, but I've never forgotten it. It's always been kind of on the forefront of my mind. Just this crazy, you know, film that I watched. And it was probably one of my early independent films that because it definitely has the indie vibe. It's very gritty. Like, the lighting's not great. You know, that you could tell it was shot with what they had available, kind of thing. And, I've just never forgotten it. So I'm excited for this doc.
Yeah. So I need to watch that. You asked me off here. I really want to watch that film because I like the cast. I like Rosario Dawson, but I'm aware of the, controversy surrounding the film, and controversy, like what they say, all attention is good attention, all controversy is good controversy, apparently. So gets people wanting to watch it, so I should really fast track that, especially if I'm going to watch the documentary about the film. So I imagine next week I'll be telling you how much I did enjoy or didn't enjoy that film.
Harmony Korine is the credited writer on Kids, which I did not realize. So
okay so keeping it in-house. Well, I've gone for a film called Brighton Fourth for my next one. It's a... genre is New York and drama. So there you go. It's a feature which is a joint collaboration between Bulgaria, Georgia, Monaco, the state of Monaco, Russia and the USA. And this one is directed by Levan Kogashvili, who he had a film called Street Days, Blind Dates, which are all very well received. And one of his films actually won an award at Tribeca 7 years ago. So he has precedence with this festival. But this is it's already been compared to The Wrestler, the Mickey Rourke film, in terms of like the rawness of it. This film is synopsis. Former wrestling champion Kaki, played by Levan Tediashvili, who was once a former Olympic wrestler himself. He always has his family on his conscience. And this leads him on a cross-continental journey. After making arrangements to cover for his brother's gambling debts, Kaki departs his humble home in the Republic of Georgia to pay a visit to his son, Soso, in outer Brooklyn. As Kaki settles into Soso's Brighton Beach boarding house, which constitutes a pop-up community of fellow Georgian immigrants, he learns that Soso has also accrued a $14,000 debt to the local mob boss, a roadblock to Soso's future in medicine. So it's a jaded old wrestler who's having to is a family man who's going from Georgia, the Republic of Georgia in Eastern Europe, to New York to see his son. His son's in deep with the sharks. I think this has the potential to be fairly hard hitting, this drama. I liked The Wrestler with Mickey Rourke. Again, that's very raw. Aronofsky film, very raw. And this seems to have all the potential to be up there based on the synopsis, based on what else I read about it. And Eastern Europe, European filmmakers, they get it. They get it. I've said that in other shows. You know, European filmmakers, they know how to make a you know, a hard-hitting, gritty, raw drama, personal drama film. So that has got my attention. So a little film called Brighton Fourth, which is available to stream from June the 15th at home.
I didn't actually preview that one, so I'm excited after hearing about it. I'm very like, oh, that sounds totally up my alley.
Yeah.
Same. This one's actually similar. This movie is called Italian Studies. It is the world premiere. It's part of the Spotlight narrative. So Spotlight narratives are not in competition, but they really are highlighting this movie. Mm-hmm. I am not familiar with, I actually am, the New York-based auteur, Adam Leon, who did a movie called Tramps that I reviewed with Corey on Movie Club a while back. It was a Netflix original. Really liked that movie. It's got one of the guys from Green Room, if I remember correctly, is the lead in it. And so this New York auteur skillfully drops the audience into this neo-realist wonder of a film that finds a mysterious woman, played by Vanessa Kirby, wandering the streets of Manhattan in confusion, seemingly unsure of who she is or where she's meant to be. Finding herself inexplicably drawn to a charismatic teenager, she embarks on an adventure with him through the cityscape and into the unknown. I'm a big fan of New York movies, so I'm instantly kind of into this idea. Obviously, this is a New York film festival, so any type New York movies get a lot of hype around this festival. They especially want to give tribute to those New York filmmakers and give them a place to really showcase their films. I'm in on that. So this movie sounds really interesting. It's listed as drama, and that's it, and women, but I'm guessing maybe because it's a woman's protagonist. But I like what I've seen of Vanessa Kirby. I still haven't watched her Oscar-nominated performance yet, but this movie sounds interesting, so I'm in.
Yeah, they describe it as a lucid dream of a film that simmers with a mesmerizing renegade energy. So that's pretty cool. Maya Hawke's in it as well. Ethan Hawke and Uma Thurman's daughter. So
very cool.
She's a New York native.
I believe she is in Supernatural. Not Supernatural. Stranger what's the Things. Show? Stranger Things season 3, if I'm not mistaken.
She is in that, and she was in Little Women, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. So she's obviously picked up the bug from her parents, the acting bug.
She's really good in Stranger Things. I don't remember her in those other two movies, which is probably, I mean, both of those movies are ensembles. So
probably there you go. Smaller parts, maybe. Did you want to have another one, mate?
Yeah, you know what? I do. This one also, I'm so happy I clicked on this one. Because it's also part of the Viewpoint series, and I was kind of going through the Viewpoints, and I didn't even notice on the banner image until just now that Thomas and Mackenzie is blatantly right there. Like, I'm looking at her. it also stars Essie Davis, who most people will know from The Babadook. And if you don't know The Babadook, you should totally watch The Babadook.
She's in Baby Teeth Country.
It's called The Justice of Bunny King. So it's not the best name. It's not as bad as The Devil Made Me Do It, but nevertheless... it is listed as a drama. It is also a New Zealand film. But Bunny King spends her days washing car windshields on a busy street, pocketing the change she earns and tips. For now, she is sleeping on her sister's couch, but she's saving up for a place of her own. What Bunny wants more than anything is to be reunited with her two children who've been placed in foster care. And until she finds her own house, family services won't let her act as their parent. When a plan that would finally allow Bunny to bring her kids home falls apart, Bunny is forced to become a champion not only for herself and her children, but also for her teenage niece, Tanya, played by Mackenzie, who's desperate for her help. This is the first feature for Gaysorn Thavit, but I'm so on board with this. It's definitely going to be an emotional film, but I think these two actresses are tremendous and can definitely bring a lot to it. So I'm hopeful for this. Totally sounds like a compelling story. I like movies that bring attention to these type of issues where there's this seemingly imbalance. Like, I don't know, maybe Bunny is messed up. Maybe Bunny shouldn't have her kids, or maybe the system is not perfect. And that could be, and again, this, we're talking of a New Zealand system in this case, but nevertheless, sometimes these systems, we see the same problems in different areas, and bringing attention to them is a great use of film. So I'm excited to check this one out.
Yep, that one sound, the talent involved sounds great. Essie Davis is wonderful in The Babadook. She was great in Baby Teeth, and she's really good in The True History of the Kelly Gang as well. So she's
an
excellent actress. But she, when it comes to drama, gets it. He nails it. So this, that sounds like a, I'm not going to say an awful lot of fun because it doesn't, but it sounds like, no, it could be a hell of a film. Fingers crossed, my friend. Good show. I'm glad you picked that one as well, Mike, because I hadn't seen that one.
Next the one title is not attention grabbing, right? Like, so
yeah, it's a bit kind of, like I say, it's a bit vanilla. It's not exactly the most exciting thing, but then reading that synopsis, there's a pull there. My next film is something called We Need to Do Something. It's a horror film. It's listed as a horror LGBTQIA film, which is available to stream from the 16th of June, Wednesday, 6 p.m. EST. And the synopsis reads, for teenager Melissa, family dysfunction is the norm. When a freak tornado traps Melissa inside the family home's bathroom with her parents and younger brother, those rifts are exacerbated. And as their confinement within the increasingly more claustrophobic by the hour lavatory stretches to multiple days, the situation grows extremely volatile. But there's more than just hard feelings threatening the family. Something evil is beyond the walls, toying with them. Is this a family's reckoning at the hands of a higher power? Or was it unintentionally triggered by Melissa and her girlfriend Amy? Whatever the cause is, one thing's for certain. All hell is about to break loose. It's directed by Sean O'Grady, first time director. It's called a single location funhouse of horrors, starting off intense as hell and steadily tightening its grip, unpredictable, unhinged and laced with offbeat humor, wildly fun as it is deeply disturbing. God damn, I'm in already just by that. Sierra McCormick, Vanessa Shaw, Pat Healy, Lizzie Alexis, John James Cronin are your stars for this film. Just that synopsis alone, man, was enough to make me think I am totally in. It's part of the midnight section on on Tribeca, so there will be, it won't be for younger viewers, of course, but I'm in. I think they're going to play into a lot of elements here, just based on that synopsis. There's a lot going to be going on, and damn, deeply disturbing but wildly fun. Damn, I'm in.
Yeah, Pat Healy is always good in these type of movies too. Mm-hmm. So I'm extra sold because of that. Why don't you do one more there, bud?
Do you know what? I'm going to pull a JB and I'm going to do that. This one I've thought looked interesting, and I certainly hope it does. We hear rumors in the underworld of what it, whether it's good or not. We've heard those, but we'll save our opinions on that or other people's. This is a film called Werewolves Within. Horror, comedy, mystery, available from Thursday, June the 17th, if you want to watch it at home. Directed by Josh Rubin, who had a film at Sundance last year called Scare Me. And he's also directed a lot of shorts, including The Last Degree of Kevin Bacon. And this is Sam Richardson, Milana Vayntrub, Michaela Watkins, Shayan Jackson, Glenn Fleshler, and Harvey Guillen. And I'll tell you what it's about. Forest Ranger Finn Wheeler, which is Sam Richardson from Veeps, is jazzed about his latest assignment, temporarily living inside the Beaverfield Inn, a cosy, woods-bound nook run by nice folks and frequented by Beaverfield's colourful array of residents for the duration of a new pipeline construction project. Little does he realise his timing couldn't be worse. For one, a major snowstorm is set to rid him and the inn's occupants of communication with the outside world, and two, something is on the loose and brutally murdering Beaverfield denizens, perhaps something lycanthropic. As the body count rises, it's up to Finn to play the reluctant hero and figure what or who is shrinking Beaverfield's population. Yes, I do enjoy a horror film, but I like a horror film like the last one, which could be dripping in just absolute dread and tension, but I also like a light-hearted comedy as well. And this, if it's good, could be a lot of good fun. Delightfully macabre whodunit monster movie, it's called, based on Ubisoft's popular VR game of the same name. So video game film as well. Can it be better than some of the rest of the naff stuff we've had in that genre? Again, could be good, might not be. As with all these films, I'm willing to hang my hat on it though. So hopefully it's good. Werewolves Within, horror comedy, which might have some werewolves within it. That's not a spoiler. It's in the title. Werewolves of End is my next choice.
I'm hopeful. We've had some funny, good werewolf movies in recent years, so let's hope. I say let's just do one more each, just for time's sake.
I think you're right.
I'm going to pull this one because I think this one is the one that I am the least aware of prior, but it is connected to Florida. And so I'm you know, I'm in Florida, so I figured why not. This is part of the U.S. narrative competition. It is called God's Waiting Room. And it's in the thick heat of Central Florida. So I'm like, hold up. I'm in Central Florida. So that's 100% why I'm interested in this. And I'm just going to throw it out there. But Rosie, played by Nizalda Gonzalez, is a musician fresh out of high school, can't shake her boredom. Before long, she meets Jules, Matthew Leone, probably Leone, a hustler from New York. So we have the crossover here of New York and Florida. She falls hard for his streetwise charms and his easy confidence. On the other side of town, Brandon, Tyler Riggs, who is also our director, writer, and I think editor. So Riggs is heavily involved in this film. Returns home after a decade in prison, but his transition to life on the outside is dogged by the scars of his past. The summer drags on, pushing these three characters together down a dangerous path. It might be a little overdramatic, but, you know, I am intrigued because it's Florida-based. And apparently Tyler Riggs moved from Florida to New York to study acting in, at the age of 21. In 2015, he produced and starred in Boomtown alongside Rachel Brosnahan. God's Waiting Room is his feature-role directorial debut. And again, he produced, he directed, he wrote the screenplay, he's the editor, and he's a co-star. He did take the third lead based on the synopsis. So maybe a little too ambitious, but good for him. It's Florida. I like that he's, you know, centering it around Florida, where he comes from. So I'm intrigued. I'm trying to do I know this guy? Because Tyler Riggs sounds so familiar. But it's
reach
possible.
Out, man.
Maybe it's one of my former students and I just don't remember. I hope not. I would feel awful. But it could be. Or maybe he knows one of my former students. Nevertheless, I couldn't resist putting that on the list given that it was centered around Florida. Hopefully it's very good.
Yeah, got a shout out to your hometown or your home state. So, for one more, there is the horror film I wanted to shout out called Honeydew. That sounds like it could be pretty scary. Check that out. But the film I'll focus on for my last one is, from the Spotlight Narrative, section, and it's called False Positive, and it's a thriller directed by John Lee, who directed Broad City, Pee-wee's Big Holiday, Search Party, and some televisual stuff as well. And it's got a decent cast in this one. The synopsis, after difficult struggles with fertility, loving couple Lucy, who's played by Elena Glazer, and Adrian, Justin Theroux, seem to have finally found their potential saviour in the charming and world-renowned reproductive specialist Dr. Hindle, Pierce Brosnan. But as their dreams begin to come true and hope transforms to happiness, cracks start to appear in a facade of normalcy, sending the now expectant mother into a spiral of suspicion that threatens her grasp on reality. It's called a clever and chilling look at gender roles and the notion of unconditional trust. Unexpectedly twisted tale. It's got a memorable turn from Gretchen Mol, apparently, as well. So this looks like it could be... this seems more like a heart pounding type thriller to me, the idea or like a psychological thriller as well. So good cast. The story sounds very promising, and yeah, the description there, I say clever and chilling. I mean, little things like that make me very, Sophia Bush is also in it. I'm very easy to win over. Just give me something like that, which sounds exciting, which sounds like it's got a stakes and it sounds psychological. I mean, this is available to stream from Friday, June the 18th, and I believe it would be going to Hulu not long after. It's US, A24 attached to this as well, so it's got people behind it.
There you go. And again, we want to remind, there are a lot of other movies that we are not previewing right now, so check out TribecaFilm.com. And look at all of the at-home viewing on the festival to see what else is there. We're going to watch more movies than what we mentioned even. Mm-hmm. And again, all of our reviews will be at BurkeReviews.com and at whatiwatchtonight.co.uk, just to make sure that all of our readers have access to both of our thoughts. Matt and I are going to split the work, so we're not going to necessarily both write about each, but we will be talking about several of these films on the next couple of episodes of this podcast. So just by coming back, you will get to hear our general thoughts, spoiler-free. We will do spoiler-free for all of the Tribeca coverage. We won't do a spoiler episode because, again, some of these movies won't be available to the public for a while. And so we don't want to accidentally have someone spoiled something they can't even see for a year.
Slightly redundant as well, where some may not get distribution sadly at all, or not for a year. Yeah. So yeah, but yeah, that, looking forward. So looking forward to this, man.
Yeah, we're going to be, that'll be the next couple of episodes. We'll probably cover the big releases around the globe in our media consumption, which is where we're going to go next. We're going to get into media consumption, which is movies, TV, video games, music, podcasts, etc., that we use to pass the time between our recordings. And Matt, you're going to start us off. What have you seen since the last time we recorded?
I am going to, and thankfully, mine is also a short list because I've been busy. I was busy last week for reasons I'll get into later, but I partially watched Cleopatra, the 1963 top grossing film of that year. It's four hours long on Disney Plus. So I'm splitting that one up. We'll be covering that on astrology in our next episode. So as the top grosser, got to watch it. So I'm on it now. I'm doing the devil made me do it, and I'm doing the devil's work. So, hey, look, it could be great. But I've watched the first hour of it, so I've started. But all thoughts will be on astrology. I also watched Cruella, which you watched last week with your wife, and you said you enjoyed it. And I can say I'm on the same path as you there, friend. I really had a good time with Cruella. I was surprised how much I enjoyed this film. I think Emma Stone was good. Emma Thompson is like viciously good in this film. Horribly good Emma Thompson is. He's just an awful person in this film. The soundtrack was great. I don't agree that with people who are saying, it's too on the nose. The soundtrack is great. And I have there are no arguments. The soundtrack's great. There are flaws in the film. You know, maybe for me, maybe 5 minutes too long. But I really, really enjoyed it. I didn't think it was going to go certain places. There's a couple of twists in it, which I actually didn't see coming. So it surprised me. And when I came out of seeing it, I was very happily surprised. So Cruella, I'm with John, but I would happily recommend that, dude. I watched The Bad Batch episode 6 on Disney Plus. Cover that on Sessions every Friday. It's good. Again, another good episode, setting up the seeds for the final 10 episodes. And it's moving slowly to where it needs to get to. So if you like Star Wars, if you like animation, I recommend giving it a go. It's good fun with some slightly more darker elements at times for those who are more attuned to that kind of stuff. And I finally finished playing The Last of Us 2. Finally finished it. I say finally because I've just been busy, so I haven't been able to get to it as much as I wanted to last week. But every time I was playing it, I was like eking out every single minute of the hours of the night I could to play it. I was pulling late ones because I was invested. Partly also because, like a film, I want to know what happens. I'm so in with these characters, all of them. I need to know what happens to them. I don't want to go on YouTube and look at it. I want to experience this. So I was like blasting through it for that reason, but also because I was just so invested. I love this game. I think this game is excellent. A year removed from all of the hoopla and just stupidness which surrounded it, I could just play it on its own merits. And as a person who's getting into games, I've got no loyalty per se to Naughty Dog or any studio. So I'm playing it as a cynical old man. And damn, did I like this game. I think the extra 10 hours from the first game was necessary. Didn't feel bogged down. The additional characters they added so much to the game. The returning characters in the stories that they had were powerful, emotional, sad, heartbreaking. There's, every adjective under the sun. Honestly, The Last of Us and The Last of Us 2 are fantastic storytelling and narrative device. Honestly, I could go on about these for hours, and I will do it at some point, but finally finished it, and I was so very satisfied with the ending of the game.
Yeah, I also really liked that game, and I never really got the criticisms about it, but I enjoyed it very much.
Mm-hmm. Yep, and that's me though, dude. Fairly short week for, obviously I watched The Conjuring, The Devil Made Me Do It as well.
Yeah. So I listened to the most recent episode of Blank Check Podcast where they covered Shaft from 2000, which I also watched for the first time. Yeah. Do you know the cast in that movie? Because I only knew Samuel L. Jackson.
I know one of the cast because I have seen that film, and I wasn't a massive fan of it. But I know you messaged me the other day with a slightly surprising. It's surprising in hindsight, but then maybe not so much. But
no, an odd bit of casting. Christian Bale, Toni Collette, just those two alone. I was just like, what? And of course, Busta Rhymes. Yeah, yeah. But I thought it was entertaining. It's not a great movie, and it's super problematic in other ways. That how it tackles police relations is very interesting. I'd love to hear John Singleton talk about it. Unfortunately, he has passed away too early. But along with watching Shaft for the first time, I watched The Curse of the Cat People, another Val Lewton produced film. That one we watched for the Movie Club podcast. Corey and I, this month of June 2021, we are doing Unwanted is the theme. It's sequels that no one necessarily asked for. Speaking of which, we'll be watching Exorcist 2 this month.
Yes!
In a couple of weeks, so get ready for that. But I watched another Val Lewton film, Isle of the Dead. That one was on the Martin Scorsese Best Horror Film list. Mm-hmm. Same thing with The Changeling from 1980. I'd never seen The Changeling. I knew about it. Man, that movie's real good. And again, a great example of a horror film that I had emotional reactions to. There was dread, there was suspense, some really cool shots. Very, very cool movie. I watched a rewatch. I've seen this movie too many times, but Tenacious D, The Pick of Destiny. I am a big Tenacious D fan. I like Jack Black a lot. I think the stupid humor in it is great. The music is awesome. Really enjoy it. I finally caught the Bo Burnham's Inside, the new Netflix special that is kind of gone viral.
About this. Yeah.
It's amazing. I was already a big fan of Bo. His eye for camera placement is like unparalleled. Like, he puts the camera in some really cool places, and he did everything on this special. Like, he is alone in a room. He's the cinematographer, he's the director, he's the editor. There's so much meta stuff about the making of it, the relationship to the pandemic, mental health. It's just brilliant. It's still funny too. That's the thing. Some people are like, oh, they watched and they got depressed. I didn't. I was like, just like, wow, how brilliant is this guy? I've been a big fan of Bo's. He just continues to impress me every time he does anything.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And then after Psycho Gorman, I'm a little more open to some B horror. So I rented Willy's Wonderland for 99 cents.
Interesting. I've seen this.
It's not great. It was nowhere near as fun as Psycho Gorman. I felt like a lot of the action sequences that could have been really cool are shot too tight, where you can't really see what's going on. And then the fights are kind of boring, I thought. I was really looking forward to like some good action stuff, and a lot of them are not that cool. There's a couple of cool ones, but there's a few that are just like perfunctory. And we talked a lot about like the rules of the monsters with Quiet Place Part 2.
Yeah.
This movie definitely does not have any sense of like guidance for why the creatures do what they do or when they can do what they do. Like, it's just like, whatever, it's fine. But overall, I found it pretty enjoyable. And just the novelty of Nick Cage, you get Nick Cage to star in your movie and then never let him speak.
Yes.
Is pretty ballsy. So that was kind of interesting. And then I did complete The Haunting of Hill House. I've watched the entire season. Nice. It's the only season, because that's the epitome. I'm going to throw this in there. I bought the book, and I've read like a little bit of it. I don't read a lot, folks. I try. My brain wanders painfully when I'm reading. Like, I am all over the place. But I like what I've read so far. I'm going to actually probably read a chapter later tonight, because I haven't read for a couple days. But I am going to – it's a short book, too. I probably should have already read the whole thing. But I'm so compelled by the two movies, The Haunting, and then the TV series, The Haunting of Hill House, all of which are inspired by Shirley Jackson's novel, or it might be a novella. It's very small. But I found it at a local used bookstore. Mm-hmm. Shout out to the Book Shelter. It's very affordable. They have such a great selection, because I stared at a wall of books for like 10 minutes looking for this book, could not find it. And then my friend walked up and found it instantly right in front of my face. And I'm like, well, thank you, sir. I am going to buy this. And so I'm reading, folks. That is unprecedented. I don't have the attention span to read much anymore. So that's a book for media consumption. How about that? I don't think that's ever happened.
This is unheard of almost.
Yes. So that said, that's what we've been consuming. But all this consumption can take a lot out of us. And in order for us to continue doing this podcast every week, we must actively ensure that we are doing something to stay bloody awesome. So Matt, tell me, sir, what did you do since the last time we recorded to make sure you had efficient Bloody Awesome levels, so you don't need like an IV at the hospital for it.
No, well, my bloody awesomeometer, I try saying that after a few pints, it was off the scale since the last episode because it was half term in the United Kingdom, in the UK, which is, you know, spring break type thing, where the kids get a week off school in between term times.
Got it.
So I spent the entirety of the time with my little princess, I shall call her, aka the monster, Reagan from The Exorcist herself, my daughter Olivia. I spent the whole week with her and we did cool stuff together, you know, soft play and went to cool country parks and ate far too much ice cream and bad food. She's only five. Don't come at me. She didn't eat that much bad food. She brushes her teeth and eats vegetables and fruit more than she needs to, which is great. That's why I haven't been doing as much pop culture-y stuff, because, you know, I was doing that, which is obviously that takes precedence over everything, as you well know. Films and TV and books and video games, as it turned out, took a backseat. I did get some in, but, you know, doing the best thing to raise any kind of any levels, any emotional levels of renewal or physical levels, is spending time with your loved ones. So I did that all last week with the Nipper herself, and had a very good week, if I must say so myself. So that's how I stayed bloody awesome last week. And yours may be kind of similar in a way.
Yeah. I, instead of spending time with other people, I've been spending time doing what I want to do. As I mentioned, I am on summer break, which just started this week, but last week, we had finals, and then like the second half of the day was just whatever kind of time grading and all that. But, I actively was just, my wife, actually, part of the reason why that happened, my wife had to go out of town for work on Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. So it was like my daughter was hanging out with her friend and I was basically to my own devices. What did I want to do? And so I hung out with some of my friends. I played, you know, games. I've obviously watched a lot of movies, more than I normally can get in a week. I think Saturday and Monday, I watched three movies each day. And so I've been just kind of doing, stuff I want to do. I've actively made sure to get some stuff prepared for next year to like, so that I could get it done now. That way I have the 2 months of my summer break, pretty much 2 months of summer break. I am doing everything in my power to break this summer. And Tribeca is just a part of that. I'm actively, my goal is three movies a day for the next 2 weeks with Tribeca. I'm going to try to watch at least three Tribeca films each day, because that's what I would do if I was in New York for the festival. I would watch three to four, maybe five films, depending on the schedule and the times and how they all overlapped and ever. But that's my time in at all film festivals. When I'm at them, you're watching movies pretty much from the time you wake up until you go to bed. And then the in-between times, you're either eating, drinking some kind of caffeinated beverage, and then writing, because that's how you get your reviews done. And I'm going to treat it like I'm in New York. I'm going to watch the movies. I'll probably order some takeout. The beauty is, obviously, you can start the movie when you want, but at the same time, like, if you're going to get three in a day, you're not going to have a lot of other things to do. I'm still going to keep up to my workout schedule, which I'm on a different workout schedule because I'm on break. Mm-hmm. So I get to actually work out in the morning, which I prefer, because then the rest of my day is like, good. I don't have to worry about working out. I've already checked that off the list. I'll work out in the morning. I'm going to watch my movies, and I'm super stoked, man. I'm excited for Tribeca. This is, last year's Tribeca was real disappointing because I had planned on going in person and then that was shut down, and they were one of the first festivals to go online. So they were up against, how do we convert what was going to be a physical normal film festival to one of the first ever online festivals, where it was all going to be available as much as they could. They had, you know, different distribution issues because some movies probably wouldn't allow them to do that. There was definitely a concern of piracy. Like, is this going to be secure enough? All sorts of factors. Tribeca was limited last year. So this year, seeing what they've added is leaps and bounds different. And a lot of festivals have happened online since Tribeca had to do it last year. And you can see the change in atmosphere and structure and function. So I'm much more excited to get into this one. Especially, we had a really positive experience with Fantasia Fest last year, which was a few months into the pandemic. So they had a little more time to prepare. They definitely felt that when we got to the movies, like, it felt like they were prepared to be online.
Yeah.
And we saw some really great movies there. So I'm excited. I'm looking forward to it. So me time is going to continue. I had a lot of me time, but I think that's going to be a kind of a theme of my summer will be, what does Birkenfield need to be functional? And that's what's going to happen. So that's how I'm saying bloody awesome.
Great job, my friend. Always going to look out for yourself. And yeah, you do it, man. You go and crush summer.
I'm going to crush summer. Especially, I'm trying to bulk up a little bit, sir. Getting those muscle lines on my arms and such. You know, been on this weight loss journey for 2 years. I've been at a steady weight for over a year now, which is great. You know, because that was always the fear when you lose weight is that you're going to immediately gain it right back. And so sustaining it during a pandemic for a year was a win. And now I'm looking to get a little stronger, a little more muscle, and hopefully lose the last 20 pounds that I've been struggling to lose for the last year. But even if I don't, I am going to still be stronger. So that's a bonus.
That's it. Anyone can do it. Book can do it.
That said, folks, that's the end of this episode. We will be back next week with Tribeca coverage. We're not going to tell you what movies yet because I think what we want to do is find which ones we want to bring to the episodes, and we won't know that till we see them. We don't want to waste anyone's time and we don't want to downplay movies. The one thing about festival films is some of these filmmakers, this is their first opportunity, and we're not trying to, you know, ruin a young filmmaker's career with their first movie if we didn't love it. But what we do want to do is if a movie really wowed us, is we want to bring it to the attention of the public. And so that's how we're going to kind of approach our coverage. So we can't predict what we're going to want to talk about next week, but all we can tell you is that for sure we're talking about movies at the Tribeca Film Festival, as well as we will probably talk briefly about In the Heights, because I've been waiting to watch that movie for a long time and I'm very pumped to see it, but it will not be the centerpiece of our episode next week. Next week we'll be focused on Tribeca. So check out TribecaFilm.com and, see if there's any movies that you want to watch. And if so, tweet at us or hit us up on Instagram. Tell us what you're watching at Tribeca. Where can they find us on Twitter, Matt?
Well, to do that, you want to go to Twitter and search at BAMP_podcast, BAMP_podcast. What about Instagram?
And on your phone, click that little camera icon that is, you know, rainbow colored that says Instagram on it and search Bloody Awesome Movie Pod there. And of course, if you're still on the Facebook, check out Bloody Awesome Movie Podcast there as well. Individually, you can follow me at BurkeReviews.com and at BurkeReviews on all the social media platforms. And Matt?
WhatIWatchTonight.co.uk. What I watch tonight. Get the words out across all of the socials and Letterboxd too.
And of course, if you do like this podcast and if you've made it this far, you must like us a little bit. Take a minute, rate and review us on whatever podcast catcher you are using to download our episodes. We will be ever, ever so grateful. And with that, we encourage you to keep watching movies
and stay bloody awesome. Blood, 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 bloody, 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 blood, blood, bloody. Awesome. Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.